Tell you what, just give me a peppy vamp.
Okay, and I can counterpoint it with...
No counterpoint! Vamp! Peppy!
Mike, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Hi, Kyle. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, that's great. I mean, the thing about it is I knew that you were the perfect person to talk about this song that we're talking about here today. One that I think is probably one of the most pivotal in Sondheim's career. And I know that you have a lot of history with both him and music in general. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today.
My great pleasure.
You know, I want to jump right into this. So we, of course, are talking about the Ballad of Buzz Cola here today. The lyrics go like this. President or Ayatollah, everyone loves new Buzz Cola with lemon.
President or Ayatollah, everyone loves new Buzz Cola with lemon.
Mike, I'm wondering which of those lyrics speaks to you the most?
Boy, I got to say... Well, the Sondheiminess of them all, I think, is the very end with the with lemon, because that's a little extra syncopation and also a little pithy observation on life and how, you know, life comes with lemons sometimes. I think that's what we were trying to say when Steve and I worked on the song.
I think that you hit the nail on the head here. I mean, sometimes people accuse him of selling out this late in his career, but I think that any time that you can bring in lemons into a song... It adds that little extra spice.
That's right. It reminded me a little bit of someone in a tree. Those were perhaps that tree was a lemon tree.
That's right. That's right. Mike, thank you so much for coming here on our April Fool's Day episode. maybe you can just maybe describe a little bit about who you are and what it is that you do.
Sure. Well, my job is that I am a writer and producer for The Simpsons. I've been here at The Simpsons for about 18 years, since 2002, and I also am the co-creator and the executive producer, showrunner of a show, animated show on Netflix called F is for Family, that I do with the great comedian Bill Burr.
I want to get to all of that. I guess I have some notes that I actually wrote down here, and the way I wanted to phrase this is, when did you know you were funny?
Boy, I don't know. You know, I had an uncle who's still with us. I love him. His name is Al, Uncle Al. And he used to come, whenever I'd see him at like family gatherings when I was a little kid, he'd say, "Hey, Mike, tell me a joke." So I had a joke book and I remember telling him dumb jokes. And I can't remember any of them that I ever said. I can remember the first joke I ever thought of myself.
Yeah.
Which I'll tell to you. It was, must be when I was like 6 years old. And because it's from 6 year old, it has a potty humor element. Which was that it was the punchline of it is about a guy who has trouble, is constipated. And the punchline of it is, with friends like these, who needs enemas? So that was the first joke I ever wrote.
And it killed probably the room. Someone else,
it killed with Uncle Al at Christmas, whenever that was. You know, I come from a funny family. I have three brothers. I grew up in New Jersey, Irish Catholic, where basically our soul. Form of entertainment aside from watching TV was just making fun of each other. So you had to be kind of fast and quick with zingers and one-liners with each other. So I think that's probably where it started.
Now, was the progression always to work in television, or was it like maybe theater, maybe like, I don't know, in print? Like what was the drive there?
Yeah, I was always a theater person as a kid, even though as a kid growing up, I was completely obsessed with TV and movies. Watching them on TV. I grew up in the New York area in the 1960s and 70s, where there were six TV channels. There were the three network channels, and there were three local channels, and a seventh channel, which was PBS. And they would show all these old movies and old Bugs Bunny cartoons and W.C. Fields and the Marx Brothers and Abbott and Costello. And I just loved them so much, thought they were so funny. I became kind of obsessed with learning the names of all the actors in the shows. And I went to the local library and took out books on movies. And then as I got a little bit older, I started acting in school plays and liking acting. And then as I got into high school, I started doing community theater and school theater, and that's where I felt like, okay, this is who I am. I'm a theater person. And then I went into the theater major in college at Montclair State College in New Jersey, and then I went on to I went to Tulane University in New Orleans. I have an MFA in theater directing, but all that sort of led to. Couldn't quite figure out how to make that into something.
right.
And I returned to my love of comedy and being funny, and I got involved in doing improv and sketch comedy in New York, and that eventually led to me being able to do this for a living.
At least in the early part of your story there, I feel quite aligned. We might be separated by just a couple of years, but my parents were a big comedy fan. So like at a probably too young of age, they were showing me like Mel Brooks movies and Monty Python and the Marx Brothers they would bring and show to me and stuff like that. So I was like, had all these cultural references that not a single person in my age group understood or knew what I was talking about. But I loved all of that kind of stuff.
Oh, so, I did too. I mean, I'm going to tell you how old I am. I won't tell you exactly how old I am, but old enough that it predates VHS.
Right.
And so the only way to experience things back then would be through records. So I had a lot of records, and they used to put out these records that were audio clips from Marx Brothers movies or W.C. Fields movies and comedy albums, of course. My best friend growing up, his father worked for a record company. So all these comedy albums. So there are all these comedy albums that were like sketch comedy albums. There was a whole segment of them that were about Jewish stuff. I'm not Jewish. He's not Jewish. But there were these things called When You're in Love, The Whole World is Jewish, and You Don't Have to Be Jewish, with like Lou Jacoby and Jack Gilford and all those great guys. Just love those.
Those types of things are kind of, I guess you can find YouTube compilations and stuff. I don't know. It's not quite the same of like finding that like a little record, blowing the dust off and be like, oh, this is like this special thing that only I get to experience.
Yeah.
You wrote me this very lovely email that kind of detailed some of your history with Stephen Sondheim. I want you to tell me a little bit more about June Moon.
Sure. Well, this also sort of inadvertently leads to how I ended up meeting Stephen Sondheim and having him be on The Simpsons to do that song, The Ballad of Buster Bumblebee, in the show. So my first memory of even knowing anything about who Stephen Sondheim was or his work was hearing probably Comedy Tonight. I think there was a show when I was a kid that was a comedy, like a summer comedy special series where they sang Comedy Tonight, and I thought it was a funny song. And then not long after that, I saw the movie version of Funny Happened the Way the Form on TV, and I thought that was great. And then I think I said in my little letter to you that I was in my very first ever community theater kind of after school during the summer production of Bye Bye Birdie. And there were older kids there, and the director was a somewhat older guy. He was probably 30, but, you know, to us.
Right. You know, might as well have been 60, yeah.
And these guys were really active in the big community theater in town. So, and the piano score for Company had just been released by Music Theater International, whoever. And they would sit around the piano. We'd do Bye Bye Birdie song, and then they have a break. And then they would break out the Company score, and he would play it all through. And all these guys were singing, like, all the songs from Company. And I was like, what is this? You know, and I was 12 years old, but I said, wow, this is theater, you know. And then a year or two after that, it's 1974. And like I said, I watched everything that was ever on TV, ever. And I have a weird kind of encyclopedic memory of everything. And I was watching Channel 13, which is a PBS station in New York, and they had a series there called like the American Theater, something like that, American Playhouse. And there's an old play from the 1920s called June Moon that's by George S. Kaufman and Ring Lardner, and it's about Tin Pan Alley songwriters. And it's sort of a funny play, sort of dramatic. It starred Jack Cassidy, Estelle Parsons, Susan Sarandon was in it, Austin Pendleton was in it. And one of it's set at this Tin Pan Alley music songwriting publishing company where one of the main supporting characters is a guy named Maxie who just sits at the piano the whole time, sort of noodling on the piano. And his job is to play new songs that come in. But he was played by Stephen Sondheim. And he's wearing this little kind of Homburg hat. And he's sitting there. And it's the funniest part in the play because all he gets to do is sort of just do these kind of really droll one-liners. There's one where, because one of the characters is a young man who's like a total rube, like from the sticks, who's a songwriter, and he's excited about being in New York, and he says,
"And I seen the Goddess of Liberty, too. I mean, the statue, she cost $1 million and weighs 225 ton.
She ought to cut out sweets."
Hey! Hey, you can play the piano.
Oh, yeah.
And I seen the President Harding just getting back from London or Europe or somewhere.
Imagine.
Have you been through the Holland Tunnel?
No, I haven't.
Have you been through the Holland Tunnel?
No.
Have you been through the Holland Tunnel, Mr. Schwartz?
I've been waiting for somebody to go with.
I'll go with you.
No, that kind of thing is very droll. And he's so funny in it and so low-key hilarious. That I think somewhere around the time I put it together that's Stephen Sondheim, because I saw the name afterwards. And after that, I just fell in love with him. Growing up in New Jersey, I would hear about shows on Broadway. We didn't go to Broadway that much. My parents didn't like New York. My father was afraid
right,
to go
right.
to New York, especially in the 70s. It was kind of a rough time. But I would read about things. I remember reading about Pacific Overtures when it first came out, because the New York Times was the way to read about everything. And then, long story short, I went to go to college, became a theater major in college, and then I saw the original Broadway production of Sweeney Todd with Lynn Carrier.
Oh, okay, yeah.
A bunch of my buddies, we took the bus in to see it, and I already loved Sondheim by then, but then it was just full on.
You know, I would love to hear your perception on that, because, like when I was getting into musical theater, it was already like post a Sweeney Todd universe. Like, how was that initially received? Like, I feel like it would have been a bit mind-blowing to see what was essentially murder, and like what they were trying to do is make like this movie come to a life on stage. I think that was their biggest thing that they were trying
yes.
to do.
It was unbelievable. It was mesmerizing, as I remember it. I mean, it was now 40 years ago
right.
plus I saw it. But we had seats all the way in the back of the orchestra of the, it was called the Eurus Theater then, I think it's called the Gershwin Theater now, right by where Circle in the Square is. And it was massive theater, but the set, Eugene Lee's set, unbelievable, that giant foundry that he brought over from England somewhere, unbelievably great, trap doors, the effects were incredible, Lancario, that's one thing I was going to go off on a little bit of a tangent here, is that the main record of that production mm-hmm. is the version they made for television, for Showtime, I think it was, or for PBS. Which was shot out here in Los Angeles when they were doing the American tour, the Los Angeles production. Angela Lansbury, fantastic. For whatever reason, Len Cario didn't do it out here. It was George Hearn, who I have great admiration for, but he was nothing on Len Cario.
You listen
to Len Cario in the record and you see George Hearn. I think George Hearn is a better singer in a way, technical singer, like a deeper singer. But Len Cario, man, he just acted mm-hmm. the hell out of that part. He was so incredible. And so it's hard for me to watch that TV version for that reason, because it's not Len, it's George. But also because for a purely technical reason, the theater they did it out here in LA, which was called the Schubert Theater, which doesn't exist anymore, didn't have trap doors. There's an amazing effect that only if you saw the original production you would have seen, which is that at the beginning of the show, when the audience is taking their seats, these guys are on the middle of the stage, they're digging a grave. So they're literally digging a grave with like shovels. And as they're digging the grave, they're on a platform, like a trapdoor platform that is slowly lowering. So they're shoveling dirt out, and they start out like at stage level, but then they slowly sink, and they're digging a grave for like a half an hour. They're just digging a grave. And you see the hole grow, but it's just the trap door going down. And then they start the prologue. And then at the beginning of the prologue of Sweeney Todd, when you hear that, and that very first, these guys come out with Sweeney Todd's body wrapped in a shroud, and they throw it down the hole. So like, throwing it down the hole, right? Todd's body. And then the song starts, you know, Tend the Tale of Sweeney Todd. And then as the song builds and builds and builds and builds, and then when Sweeney first shows up, you know, Tend the Tale of Sweeney Todd, he is standing in the grave, mm-hmm. coming up out of the floor, like with this underlit. I can never forget it. I'll never forget how great it was. So there's a light shining under him, and he's rising out of the grave as he sings, Tend the Tale of Sweeney Todd.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
He served a dark and a vengeful God.
He served a dark and a vengeful God.
What happened then? Well, that's the play, and he wouldn't want us to give it away. Not Sweeney.
Not Sweeney Todd. The demon on the feet. Sweet.
Unbelievable. And then they do it again at the very end of the show after, spoiler alert.
Yeah, really. Spoiler alert for this 40-year-old show that we're about to spoil.
Everybody's dead. But at the very, very end of the show, when they do the final, like the reprise of the Tenth Hail Sweeney Todd, and they do it again, and then at the very end, then they both come rising up. It was both of them, Len and Joe Lansbury, Mrs. Love and Sweeney Todd, both rising up out of the hole, doing the last part. Oh, my God. So incredible. What an amazing production. And the very end of it is, the whole back wall of the theater was this corrugated metal, like, wall. And Len Carey was the last one on at the very end. He goes, and he leaves and he slams the door behind him with that corrugated metal wall. It goes, bang, like that. Oh, my God.
Yeah, like, what an experience.
I can still see it. You know, and then afterwards, we were so excited. We thought it was so great. And then as we're leaving the theater, we're like walking down the street and we saw the guy who played the judge, Edmund Lindeck, his name, walking down the street, just kind of go home to his apartment. We kind of chased him down the street and like talked to him and everything. And it turned out he had gone to our college many years earlier in Montclair State. And anyway,
that's cool. That's cool.
A kid again when I think about that show.
You know, but I think what you hit on, which is really interesting, and maybe it's just because I, you know, fell in love with musical theater at a very young age. And it's something, I guess, that is broadly similar between shows. But I find Sondheim has had a very clear example of this, of people that their voices just fit so well with the songs that they're singing. Like, I think about, like, the original Send in the Clowns with Glynis Johns, right? Like, I've heard better singers sing that song, but I don't think anyone's ever sung it as good as Glynis Johns sings that song. And the same thing with Len Carey. I think he's a great singer, but he was getting older at that time, so, like, he couldn't hit the high registers that even, like, a younger Len Carey could. But for whatever reason, that's the version I like the most. Like, his version of Joanna is just, like, that is like top songs for me. So I don't know. It's interesting how musical theater allows me to appreciate people that may not have like the best singing voice, quote unquote, but it still fits with what they're doing.
But boy, did he act, and he acted the hell out of that part. Like he just lived it, you know? And of course, I mean, you're biased because it's the first thing you've ever seen or heard, you know? So then of course I got the record, right after that, and like I've listened to the record, you know, a million times, you know, and I saw the subsequent productions. I saw the Bob Gunton one, which was Circle in the Square. Mm-hmm. That was 1989. That was pretty good. He was fine. And the good thing about that one was they put in the judge's whipping song in that production. And then my wife and I went to see the version, the very stripped down Doyle version with Patti LuPone and Michael Cerveris, which was fine. But I love Patti LuPone. She was incredible. He was good. We sat near some people who had never seen Sweeney Todd before, and that show was incredibly bare bones. I mean, it was so stripped down. It was a thing where the actors played the instruments as well, and the set was just like these planks and these benches, and it was all very symbolic. Whenever someone had their throat slit, it was just Sweeney Todd pouring like a bucket of red paint into another bucket. That was it. That was the way. So these people were sitting next to us after the show was over, and they were like, that was really good. And they were like, what happened?
Yeah.
They didn't know what the play was about. They couldn't follow it.
That's what I've actually heard about that version, which is like, if you knew Sweeney Todd going in, it was a really interesting exercise, but not a great first introduction to that show.
So that show has gone from maximalist. Kill myself. I kicked myself. I didn't see the one they just did a year or two ago where it said the actual little pie shop.
Yeah, that'd been cool.
Or Barrow Street. I wish I could have seen that. So it's time for like a maximalist production again.
Go full out.
Revive that original Prince production one more time.
Does that mean then, having, you know, been a Simpsons fan for many years, is that the reason why we get like Sondheim references every so often? Is that because of you specifically?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I joined the show in season... it was season 13 was on TV when I started it. So there had been some Sondheim stuff before that. Memorably, you know, Krusty Sang, Send in the Clowns.
Right, yeah, that's right.
Send in the clowns. Those daffy, laffy clowns. Send in those soulful and doleful schmaltz by the bowlful clowns. Send in the clowns.
They're already
But then after that, yeah, anything after season 13 or 14, it's probably I have a hand in it putting some Sondheim stuff in there. And then, of course, you know, this episode that the Buzz Cola song when was in season 18, I think. And there's a really cool story about that. If you don't mind, I can tell you.
Yeah, let's do that, because I would love to know that thought process. Is that you wanted Sondheim from the time you were writing that script, or was that an evolvement to get there?
Well, it was sort of like serendipitous in that I always loved Sondheim, of course. And I was writing a script, this script that, for those of you who haven't seen the episode, it's sort of a parody of The Sound of Music. And I'd done a previous episode the year or two before, which was a kind of a episode length parody of My Fair Lady, starring Bob Grant's keeper, Willie. He's the Eliza Doolittle of it. And Lisa is the Henry Higgins. And so Al Jean, who's our executive producer, said, well, why don't you think about doing another musical episode? And so I thought of this one, The Sound of Music. And it's about, again, Lisa is the main Simpson in it. And she becomes sort of the Maria von Trapp to all the little kids of Cletus Buckler, the yokel. So we were working on the script. And as it happened, my wife has a really good friend whose husband was one of the main producers of the Star Trek franchise at the time in the early 2000s. His name is Rick Berman. And Rick's wife, Liz, was having a birthday. And we got invited to her birthday. And it was a birthday dinner at a really nice restaurant. And we walked in and there were all these people, all the people from Star Trek were there. This is a whole different thing. All the people from Star Trek Next Generation were there. Like I was sitting next to Mr. Data, you know, and Riker. They were in their costumes. They were the regular people. But
that would have been a better story, though, if they had been in all their costumes. But
soon to be seen on the Picard show. Yeah. Coming out. Also at that dinner was a man named John Logan, who's a great playwright and a screenwriter, who at the time had written, he wrote Gladiator, and he wrote Anything Sunday, and he's since gone to write a lot of great plays. But at the time, he was working with Stephen Sondheim, working on writing the movie version of Sweeney Todd. Mm. So anyway, we were sitting near each other. We started talking, and I said, I work on The Simpsons. Said, oh, I love The Simpsons. I'm working with Stephen Sondheim. I was like, oh, my God, Stephen Sondheim. And I said, do you think he would ever want to be on The Simpsons? He goes, he might. He's kind of a, you know, he's a little bit of an actor at heart. And I said, I know. And I mentioned seeing him on June Moon in 1974. He's like, oh, my God, he would love to hear that you saw that, you know. So anyway, it just so happened I was working on the script at the time, and I talked to Al Jean. I said, there's a chance possibly to get Stephen Sondheim. And he goes, what if we wrote a scene for him in this episode? He goes, oh, yeah, try it. You know, so what happens usually when we do these things is someone from the production reaches out to the agent or something of the person, and they say, would you want to be on the show? But the way John explained it to me was, Stephen's really nice, but here's what you should do. Write him a letter. Write him an actual physical letter and mail it to his house. So John gave me his address.
Right.
So I wrote it. I spent like 2 days like working on this letter to make sure it sounded smart and nice and not too fawning, you know, because I could have just gushed all over the place.
So your first draft was 5 pages long.
Yeah, pretty much it was. I think June Moon was mentioned in there somewhere. So then I just waited and waited and waited and waited and waited. And a couple of weeks later, I opened my mail and there was a little envelope, like a square, like the size of like a thank you note, you know, and it was typewritten on a typewriter, and it said Sondheim, but at his address, New York, to me personally. Like, oh my God, there it is. And I opened it up, and he typed it out on an actual physical, like old style typewriter, saying, yes, thank you so much. I'd be interested in doing the show, and here's how you get a hold of my people. And
oh, that's cool.
So from then on, it was, oh my God, he's doing it. So then they flew me out to New York to meet him and to be there for his recording. And through kind of a happy accident for me, probably not for him, there was a mistake made with the recording studio, because he had some dialogue. He has a short dialogue scene where he meets Krusty, and we, as the Simpsons will often do with a celebrity, we kind of write like an ironic version of the character for him. So in his version of him, he was like a young, eager guy handing this song to Krusty, because Krusty had hired him to write songs for this TV special.
Yeah.
Kids, it's finally happening. Your own primetime special. The songs will be written by Broadway's greatest composer. This guy. What's your name again, Fuzzface?
Stephen Sondheim. I know you hear this all the time, but I think you're great.
And I'm sure you hear this all the time. You cost an arm and a leg, so let's get to work.
Here's the opening number.
Oh, complex harmonies?
Intricate lyrics, pithy observations on modern life. What is this junk? Where's the zazz? Just do what you did in Cats.
I didn't write Cats.
You didn't? Ah, oh, no. All right, I'll try.
Then he had to play that little song, and we had a piano for him. But there was a mistake with the studio, so the piano wasn't ready. So he agreed to come back a second day. So we did like on Wednesday, did his dialogue stuff, and then he came back on Thursday for like 20 minutes, and he sat there at a concert grand piano and played that little Buzz Cole song. And then I think he added the With Lemon part. I think that was his ad lib.
Like, interesting.
Like that. I'm pretty sure that was him. And then he did it like two or three times. And then I said, okay, can we just get one version where it's just the piano part in case we need to do that? And he goes, okay, okay. He was very nice about it the whole time.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, are we done now? I said, yeah, actually we are. I said, but only one last thing is what? What's that? You know, and I said, could you now please play for me the entire score for Sweeney Todd? And he started laughing. He's like, no. But then he put his hands on the keys and he started playing.
Oh, that's cool.
And I was like, I was done. You know, I could go, I could die now. So that was it. And then he did it. And then a year or two later, we had an idea for a Halloween segment that was sort of based on Sweeney Todd in a way. I wasn't writing it. One of the other writers, Danny Chun, was writing it. And they said, maybe we can ask Sondheim if he wants to write the songs for this. So again, I got my little typewriter out or whatever, and I wrote him a little letter, and he wrote back very nicely again saying, thank you so much, but this is too much. I couldn't do that. I couldn't spare the time to do that right now. So we ended up doing if you've ever seen that one, it's one of the Treehouse of Horrors where
it's kind of like a parody of Sweeney Todd in a way. Yeah.
So that would have been with Sondheim songs, but we ended up doing our own stuff.
See, you could have been the show that finally gave him an Emmy Award.
That's right.
And you failed him.
That's right.
You know, Mike, let's continue this conversation in just a few minutes, right after we thank a few of our sponsors. Hopefully, you're enjoying this April Fool's Day episode, which only the first part was really a joke, but let's leave it there. Let's thank some sponsors and get right back into this conversation. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode is brought to you by Park Power, a provider of electricity and natural gas in Alberta that offers low rates, awesome service, and profit sharing with local charities. Park Power is a small local business, and like many of you, it has been closely monitoring the news on COVID-19 and the world's rapidly changing circumstances. While many of their team are currently working remotely, the way Park Power does business has not changed, and their commitment to exceptional customer service will remain. Find out more about Park Power's response to the COVID-19 outbreak at parkpower.ca. Our other sponsor this week is the Alberta Podcast Network, so let's listen to one of the other great shows on the network.
Hi, I'm Emily.
And I'm Brienne, and together we make Emily Missed Out, a podcast where Emily and I dig into the long list of films that she hasn't seen yet.
It's a very long list.
Totally long list. And help her catch up on all of the pop culturally relevant lines, characters, scenes, and tropes that she may have missed out on.
We're also a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. You can find us online at albertapodcastnetwork.com or wherever you find your podcasts. Join us for my pop culture education.
Yeah.
I guess overall, you've been with The Simpsons now for quite a while. How has this job been? Did you think you were going to be working at The Simpsons for 18 years?
No one did. I mean, even the people who are, there are people who are still here, like Al.
Yeah.
And from year one, you know, and even at year one, they were like, they thought it'll be 13 episodes and over, you know. And then everyone has a story that whenever they started, they were told, well, we got maybe a couple more years left in us, you know. So it's incredible. It's certainly the greatest job I could ever have or ever want. And it's been just amazing.
Because I decided to check out your IMDb before we started recording here. I couldn't believe when I noticed that The Simpsons movie came out in 2007, because it feels like it was way quicker than that. But it's like, it's been a while since I guess that movie came out.
Almost 13 years now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Are there talks of continuing that at all, or is that going to be wait until the series is over and then we can focus on films?
There's been stuff, but nothing concrete, but I think eventually it will happen. I'm not, just not sure when.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
Yeah, we'd love to. I'd love to. It's fun.
So F is for Family. What? Yes. How did that begin? Was that your idea or Bill Burr's idea to start that?
That began with a phone call from, as often these things do, from a phone call from an agent, from my agent, saying, you know, we got a call from this company. It's called Wild West Productions, and it's run by Vince Vaughn.
Okay.
The great actor, Vince Vaughn. And it's his production company, and he runs it with another great guy, great actor, also great director, Peter Billingsley, who you may know from a former life as Ralphie from the movie A Christmas Story.
Yeah.
He's a grown man. He's a fantastic guy and a great producer and a good writer, too. But anyway, they were working with Bill. They wanted to find something to do with Bill. And Bill had mentioned, you know, he tells these stories in his stand-up act about his family growing up and his dad and how his dad would say, I'm going to put you through that wall and things like that. So he had always wanted to do like little tiny, again, Simpsons comes up. He'd thought of these as sort of like really short, like 2 or 3 minute shorts, like the original Simpsons shorts that he would put on his website. But then those guys, Peter and Vince, said, well, what if we're looking to try to develop an animated series? Would you want to try that? And he's like, oh, sure. So then Bill had no real experience in writing for animation or writing for TV. So they wanted to pair him up with someone who did. And so that's where I came in. And I had a meeting with them where we just sort of told stories about our childhoods and growing up and what it was like. And Bill's from the Boston area. I'm from the New York, New Jersey area. And I'm a little bit older than Bill. Similar, very similar family structure. And some of the stories I told made him laugh. And we felt comfortable with each other. And then we took it from there. And then together we developed the whole concept of developing who this family is and what he does. And we took it out and pitched it some places. And Netflix, thank God, said yes.
Said yes, yeah. And it should be, I guess, when this episode is coming out, the fourth season should be premiering soon, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we think, we're still waiting to find out exactly when, you know, this episode is coming out in April. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be sometime later than that, probably sometime in the late spring. We haven't heard our exact date yet, but we're almost done with it, and we're really proud with this is the fourth season coming out this year.
Do you have any, I mean, I know that you're working with Netflix here. Is there anything inherently different, I guess, from working on like a network show that you're releasing weekly versus something that, hey, we release like all these episodes all at once, here's the entire season? Or do you treat that differently?
Certainly just the difference between The Simpsons and F is for Family is in the storytelling is that Simpsons, you know, and it's been a recipe for success for 670 episodes, is that every episode is sort of self-contained and nothing changes that much and something happens radical in the middle. By the end of it, we're back to normal and, you know, and any episode could be watched in any order. But with Netflix, very early on, they impressed on us. They wanted us to try to do a different style, which is to do sort of serialization and the binge model, which at first, when we first thought of F is for Family, we saw it more as a Simpsons or Family Guy style in terms of like each episode would be its own little self-contained little story.
Yeah.
But they urged us to try the other way, and it was hard at first, but then it got really fun and really challenging. And on all honesty, those are the kinds of shows even back then and now that I love to watch. Like I was into like The Sopranos or Mad Men or Breaking Bad. To be able to write in that style was really fun and really challenge. So that's cool. And so you're plotting out an entire season of 10 episodes and finding the story arcs and all that. And then it's just as far as the physical production is concerned, that's part of the reason why it takes so long between seasons, because, you know, we get it takes a little over a year, roughly over a year or so to make all 10 episodes. But we can't release them. Netflix won't release them until they're all 10 are finished.
Right.
As with The Simpsons, when the episode is done, it's on the air a week later, you know. So that's part of the reason why it takes so long between seasons for a show like this.
But I also find interesting here, like Fox kind of like jumpstarted this entire like animation, adult animation, I'll put that in quotes, you know, when The Simpsons premiered. It doesn't seem like any other channel really tried. Well, they may try, but never were successful like with bringing primetime animation back in any like meaningful way. And Fox just found a way to do that. But now with Netflix, too, like you have this and Big Mouth and BoJack Horseman. Like it seems like they have like finding these great creators to be like, let's create some really great content here for our service. So I find like those two channels really different models for sure, like really leaning in on animation quite heavily.
Yeah, I mean, if thank God for them, you know, because I don't think our show would be able to exist. Certainly couldn't exist on a network the way it's the way it's created now with the language and everything else. And we came to them. We came to them at a really great time when they were really looking to get new stuff going. And because there's no content restrictions, there's no advertisers to get upset about or whatever. We could basically and it just fit perfectly with the kind of show that it is. And that, you know, we try not to be just crude for the sake of crudeness, but we're trying to sort of hold a mirror up in a way, a cracked animation mirror to the way people are, the way people were, the way things were back then when I was a kid. And so we're able to have people speak more or less naturally the way they do.
That's great. Yeah, I guess in our last bit of our conversation here, one other thing you mentioned in the email you sent was like the humor of Stephen Sondheim himself. And like you're in the comedy game, of course. But I agreed with what your sentiment was, is that I think Sondheim has written these really like clever, funny songs. And yet I don't, at least my sense is that people don't, the first thing that jumps into mind when you mention his name is not comedy necessarily.
No, that's true. Yeah, that's true. But I think his humor comes out in certain, in different ways. Like going back to Sweeney Todd, it's interesting because when I listen to your podcast, which is great, by the way, you know, you'll talk about the songs themselves, but then, you know, these songs were created to be part of the overall whole theatrical experience. So you can barely hear it. It's on the record of Sweeney Todd. One of the biggest jokes of all, I think, is in Sweeney Todd after, you know, the whole thing goes down with Judge Turpin and Anthony stumbling in on him. Just as about, first of all, a huge laugh in that show too is when Judge Turpin is there and he says, you know, first a shave, the closest I ever gave.
Yeah,
fantastic. But then again, in the staging of it, there's that moment where the music is getting, and he's like, yes, now, you know, now my friends, now to your purpose, you know, that part stuff, you know, patience, make haste, and if you would, my lord, you know, my ward, and he goes, shall we speak, shall we start, you know, and then the music builds and builds and builds and builds, and he's got his razor out, and he's got it right under the judge's throat, and then he starts singing Pretty Women, you know, huge laugh in the theater. I mean, that's not Sondheim writing that. I mean, he wrote the song, but it's that a huge laugh of like anticipation, and then after that, so then Anthony shows up, and you know, the whole thing gets boshed. And then he sings Epiphany, like one of the darkest things of all time. Incredibly dark and powerful. And he sings it all. We all deserve to die. And I will not have one man nor a hundred or a thousand can assuage me. But the work waits. I'm alive and I'm full of you know, like that. And then it's all that, you know. And then it's like huge. And then Mrs. Lovett goes,
that's all very well, but what are we going to do about the Italian?
Huge laugh. Like to me, that's like in the comedy business, and my ultimate, the super boss of The Simpsons, and one of the great comedy writers of all time is James L. Brooks, who, you know, created Mary Tyler Moore and Taxi. You know, he's an expert at that, which is like, we call that a drum roll. So like the A side is called the drum roll, where you build this big thing. And then the undercut comes in and gets the joke. And so that, so the drum roll is the Epiphany song, and then her saying, well, that's all very well, is the undercut, is the rug pull, as they call it in the sitcom business. So that's really funny. And A Little Priest, I think, is a hilarious song.
What is that?
It's Priest. Have a little priest.
Is it really good?
Sir, it's too good, at least. Then again, they don't commit sins of the flesh, so it's pretty fresh.
Awful lot of fat.
Only where it's at.
Haven't you got poet or something like that?
Now you see, the trouble with poet is, how do you know it's deceased? Try the priest.
I find that even the in Worst Pies of London, and it was probably not until like embarrassingly like my eighth or ninth listen, where there is actually a rhyme scheme that he messes around with, where I think what you're led to believe is he's going to say shitty, but she says, well, pity. Right. So she doesn't actually swear in that song. I don't know. There's like that funny little clever wordplay that is, I think, funny when you break it down.
That's funny too. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I just spent a lot of time listening to your series on Funny Thing,
yeah,
which I love. That's the only Sondheim show I've ever performed in. So when I was in college, I played Cenex in a
Nice. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, I was 20 years old playing
the old band, yeah.
Man, you know, so I love to get a roll hold of that part now. There's some really funny stuff in that, I think. Mm-hmm. Like Pretty Little Picture, I love. I love even like some of the really funny wordplay in the funeral scene, mm-hmm. when it's like build the pyre, right. a fire, you know, it's just really, really funny. I think he's really, really funny, actually.
One thing I discovered doing that entire season on Funny Thing is that I think that is the one that is most often like, oh yeah, and he also did this one. It's like people kind of like put it at the bottom of their lists of like best Sondheim shows.
Yeah.
And going through it song by song, it really gave me a deeper appreciation because it's like he talks about him being a chameleon and being able to like take on other people's voices and be able to write to that. It's like when you are writing like Larry Gelbart and Bert Shevlov and stuff like that, like people would go, Larry Gelbart went off and did MASH eventually too. I mean, like to be able to mimic that style, but in song is just, mm-hmm. I think, an extra level of complexity. Yeah.
There's a song too from that show that is cut from the show mostly, and I only heard it once on one of those CDs of like from one of those evenings, mm-hmm. celebrating of Sondheim, which is the Marcus Lycus song.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where he goes through every single one of the girls and sings about them, and there's the one thing that's sort of predating Company, where he goes, it's with the Gemini twins. He goes, 1 is 6 foot 3, 1 is 2 foot 3. You know what?
Or consider the Gemini, a matched pair. Either one, a divinely assembled woman. Together, an infinite number of mathematical possibilities.
Really, really funny, too. Funny stuff. Funny.
I guess besides Buzz Cola, have you written any other music before?
Only lyrics for The Simpsons. So in that whole episode of it was called Yokel Chords. So I wrote some of the parody lyrics to... in that show, we did parodies of The Hills Are Alive with The Sound of Music. We did a parody of My Favorite Things. And we did I Am 16 Going on 17, which turned out to be I Have 8 Teeth Going on 17.
Yeah.
But we sort of write those with everyone. Everyone sort of writes those all together. And for the My Fair Lady one, I remember doing that one. I was very proud of my parody of, which was I Could Have Danced All Night, because this is by Groundskeeper Willie. And it was called I Could Have Been Indoors All Night.
Right.
To it. Me grandfather used to get sent down into the mines to make sure it was safe for the canaries.
Don't you ever hope for anything better?
Something better? For Willie? All I want is a place somewhere.
And?
That's it.
So whenever we have a chance to write a song on the show, I often try to pitch in and get a lyric in here and there. And then on Episode Family, where I'm sort of the head writer, I've written a few songs for that show. So the one song I wrote completely was a jingle for, not a Buzz Cola jingle, but a jingle for our fictional airline called Mohican Airways. So I wrote the whole song for that and a couple other things. So I really like it. I mean, I think in another life, I would have been, I couldn't have been Stephen Sondheim doing both, but maybe I could have been, Adolph Green or somebody like that, you know, writing lyrics.
Turning our attention to the future, like you have these two shows that you're working on, one as a creator, writer, and one as a writer. What's next for you?
I can't really say. I mean, there's some things that are in the works, hopefully. Mm-hmm. I would say my ultimate dream would be to somehow find a way back to doing theater in some way. Mm-hmm. That's why I said, you know, years ago, I had a couple of meetings, because now there's a trend that's, in the last few years or so, there's been a trend of turning old movies into Broadway shows.
Right, yes, yeah.
So
sometimes not even old movies, it's very new movies into Broadway shows. Well,
that's true. About 10 years ago or so, I had a meeting with the producers, and I don't know if the show ever came out. But they were hoping to make the old the Kevin Kline movie Dave,
where
into a Broadway show, and so I think whatever company made that movie, Warner Brothers or whatever, they had Warner Theatricals, and they had a producer, which I forget who she was, but I had a meeting with her, and I had all these ideas like, here's what you should do. I was like sort of taking a meeting to be the book writer for that show, and I remember pitching all my wild ideas about how there could be a song and this kind of song and everything. And I don't think anything ever came out of it at all.
Right.
But that's the closest I ever got. But if there's any way to somehow work, find my way back to the theater in that way, is maybe writing a play or writing the book for a musical or as a dream, writing lyrics for songs would be great. I have an idea I don't want to say because I don't want to jinx it, but there's something I'm thinking about, which would be a thing dealing with a piece of Broadway history, maybe turn that into a movie or a TV show. So that's something
exciting.
If anything comes of that, I'll let you know.
That'd be perfect.
I can tell you that.
This is actually going through Sondheim's work now. I now have a very strong opinion that I have no problem adapting like films for Broadway, but I think the idea is to like, how do we take this movie but make it work on a stage rather than just doing the plot points from the movie and then putting songs in between them? Like, how do we actually convert this? Kind of like how we looked at like A Little Night Music from a Bergman film. It's like, how do I adapt that but make it a stage work instead of having to be so rigid with the source material? But that's another challenge in and of itself to get right.
That would be one of the things, like, you know, I wish I could ever see, and I don't know if you've ever read about it, or are you familiar with, you know, when Sondheim was first starting out, Oscar Hammerstein said, here's what I want you to do. Here are your three test cases.
Yes.
Like, adapt a piece of literature, take a play that works and take a play that doesn't work. And the one that I was fascinated with was that he wrote a whole score for Mary Poppins.
Yeah, I would love to have seen what that would have looked like.
Yeah. God willing, maybe someday that'll come out or something like that, or who knows.
Yeah. You
know? But I mean, I've seen most of his shows now. The only shows I've never seen in any form on stage are Assassins and A Little Night Music. I've never seen A Little Night Music on stage.
Well,
anything else I've seen, more or less.
Yeah, Assassins, you'll have a chance very soon because I think they're doing a new revival on Broadway sometime in the next couple of months.
Oh, great.
A Little Night Music, though, hasn't been revived for a few years here, at least. I'm flying to New York in March to go and see the new company because I'm really excited to see that.
I'm dying to see that.
Yeah.
I didn't see her.
Mm-hmm.
But Patti LuPone guest starred on The Simpsons last year, so I got to record her and direct her. But she was just in New York, and I was here, so I got to talk to her. But I told her that I saw her, all the shows I saw her in. We had just recently seen her out here. She was in that play called War Paint.
Right, yeah.
Which is very good. But I said, I saw you in Sweeney Todd. I saw you in Noises Off. And, very nice. But that was great. That was great. That's where I think someday, if I have a chance to, I'll write a part for Len Carey.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be great.
Just so I can tell him how great he was.
Just get me. Yeah. Get everyone who's ever appeared in Sweeney Todd somehow to work with them. That'd be great.
I'll be like Chris Farley in those old SNL sketches where he's like, remember that thing you were in? Yeah, that was really cool.
That was really cool, huh? Yeah.
That'll be me.
Well, thank you so much for your time here, Mike. This is really greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
If you can somehow, you know, get me animated on The Simpsons at some point, that would be really fun. But I was not expecting you to reach out the way that you did. And I'm very appreciative that we had this chance to talk with each other today.
I had a great time. And I'd come back. I'd love to come back anytime. Maybe when you get to Sweeney Todd.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we talk about a couple of songs or one song or something like that.
Yeah, we can talk about whipping people. It'll be great.
Very good. Just don't make me do the one about Sweet Polly Plunkett, the parlor song.
Right, exactly. How many bells were there? Yeah. Thank you once again.
Thank you. Thanks, Kyle.
I also want to alert you to the fact that there is going to be a bonus episode this week. There's going to be another episode coming into your feeds either tomorrow or on Friday. So that is not a mistake. That is meant to be there, and I hope that you enjoy it. Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. Also, you can follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. And you can support the show on Patreon by going to patreon.com/puttingittogetherpodcast. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, and to Park Power this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere else you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. Remember, either tomorrow or on Friday, another bonus episode is coming out. There's so much content that I'm making. I have so much free time. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. For now, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
I didn't write Cats.
You didn't?